This is Radio Boston. I'm Lisa Mullins. The troubled trains of the MBTA still aren't running on time, and they may not run on schedule again for more than a month. Now Governor Charlie Baker is saying the transportation officials are considering giving riders their money back.
I know that they are starting to have a conversation about what to do with regard to some sort of reimbursement, some goodwill gesture. I think that's probably a good idea.
Yet another challenge for the freshman governor. A new estimate shows that there's a looming $1.5 billion shortfall this year. That's billion with a B. Meanwhile, in Washington, a potential partial government shutdown could derail hopes for prompt federal aid for our weather-beaten selves. Democrats, including Congressman Jim McGovern, are upset.
You know, shutting down the Department of Homeland Security, furloughing people or not paying people, this is not the way to run a government.
In fact, even some Republicans are fed up. Here's Republican Senator Mark Kirk.
As a governing party, we got to fund DHS and say to the House, here's a straw so you can suck it up.
Opening statements in the trial of accused Boston Marathon bomber Dzhokhar Tsarnaev begin on Wednesday. The trial will be a long one. Columnist Mike Barnicle thinks the city residents have already had enough.
They want it to be over and done with. They know who did it. They know the impact it had. They know about the victims. They want it done.
Well, we'll see if our two guests today agree. Joining me now to talk about these stories and more, Nancy Gertner, former federal judge, now a professor at Harvard Law School. Hello, Nancy.
Hi.
Also, Richard Tessay. He is a former state senator and former candidate for Congress here in Massachusetts. Welcome to the program.
Happy to be here.
Nice to have you both here. How did you get here today, by the way?
Drove badly.
I'm sure that's not your fault.
Right.
Richard? I drove in. I wasn't going to go on the commuter rail.
No, I guess that you would not have made it in time for this interview if you had taken the commuter rail. Even with a reduced schedule from what we're hearing, 9 of the 12 commuter rail lines had delays this morning. The digging continues. The commuter rail operator Keolis said this week that normal service may not be restored until March 30th at the earliest. There were apologies for that as well. Here's State Senator John Keenan. He's on the Transportation Committee and represents the Norfolk and Plymouth districts on the commuter rail lines.
It's unacceptable. It's just a long period of time for people to be inconvenienced. And again, it highlights how important a role commuter rail, MBTA, and even our roads and bridges play in our daily lives. And to have that interrupted for as long as time is what they are indicating is just unacceptable.
Richard, the storms have shown how the transportation network disruption in a city like Boston can really cripple the city, cost businesses a lot, make life really difficult for residents. What's your take on this?
Well, I know Charlie Baker came out with that great quote, Mother Nature makes the rules, but I think at this point it's ridiculous. And some of the problems that we're seeing with the commuter rail in particular, you know, started long before the storm as far as it being undependable. And you know, but I think that the storm has really brought out just how bad our transportation infrastructure is. And I kind of look at this as an opportunity because you have a new now general manager at the rail company. You have a new MBTA acting manager. You have a new governor. You have a new transportation secretary. And I hope that they'll all sit down, and I think that this is what's happening right now, and put together a plan to make sure that this doesn't happen again in the future.
What would be the first thing you'd recommend in that plan?
Well, I think the governor's already done that. He's already gone out and put together a team of pretty respectable people within the transportation world to come up with a blueprint. And I think for the average commuter, it's just to make sure that the trains, run on time. And it's funny, you say March 30th, Red Sox opening day is April 13th.
Yes. So, with the marathon not long after that, right around the same time, right? Probably
exactly.
Same day.
So it's a long time before you get back to 100%.
Nancy Gertner, heard a long sigh from you. I think that's the way a lot of residents feel when they hear about the governor putting together a new committee
right,
to figure out what should be going on. How do you evaluate the job the governor has done and what should be done?
First of all, I want to raise up the level of the language. This is not just unacceptable. It is outrageous. The one thing that a government should be able to do is to deliver transportation. It's not just for the businesses, but there's stories of people who, are doing multiple jobs and relying on public transportation, and it takes 2 hours to get into town, and then they have to go pick up their kids. I mean, there's real hardship. And it seems to me that it's not just a question of another committee. It's clear that we have to make an investment. It's clear that there has to be money put on the table to improving these lines. It's sort of the minimum that a municipal government, that a state government should do.
Okay, talk about putting money on the table. There's a question right now about the T. Should riders get their money back for trains that never showed up. Governor Baker came out in favor of the proposal. Transportation Secretary Stephanie Pollock, though, this week said that there is a downside.
People do need to understand that there's only one budget. So every dollar that we give back to passengers is a dollar that won't be spent on improving.
So it sounds like you're not.
It's a tough decision for the board to make.
Tough decision. Richard, what do you think?
I would probably go with Charlie. I do think that, you know, if you're not providing the service, you should refund the consumer.
Even at a cost to the T.
Well, you know what? I think people expect to have a dependable transportation system, and God knows they haven't got their money's worth.
Nancy Gardner?
I completely agree. I mean, I think it's a question of an income transfer here, that the people who've been hurt and harmed by this, by not just the weather, but the state of the T, should get their money back, and the T should figure out other ways to be funded. I mean, this is, you know, we would no more accept the fire department shutting down or the sewer system shutting down. Public transportation should be in the category of de minimis services that citizens expect, and whatever it takes to restore it should be done.
Okay. Public transportation strapped for cash, of course, as we're saying, apparently so is the state. The nonpartisan Mass Taxpayers Foundation this week said the Baker administration faces a $1.5 billion shortfall in the budget for the coming fiscal year. The administration told the Boston Globe that the estimate is indeed within the ballpark of what the gap might be. The governor's budget comes out on Wednesday. He has promised already not to raise taxes, not to raise fees, or to tap the rainy day fund. Richard, as a Republican former legislator, how wise do you think it is to authorize what apparently are going to be pretty painful cuts to transportation, children's services, among other programs, instead of hiking fees and taxes?
Well, usually when you have a budget crisis, it's because the economy isn't doing well and tax revenues aren't coming in. But here, this is a little different. What's happening right now is that plenty of money, new money, is coming into the state tax coffers. Both the House and Senate, as well as the governor, they had all their revenue experts come in and estimated that revenues are going to increase 5% this year. That's almost $800 to $900 million in extra money.
So why the cuts?
The problem is on the spending side. Spending is increasing twice as fast as new revenues are coming in. And I think every family, every business, you know, you have to live within your means, and clearly the state isn't doing that. And you do have areas within the budget that are growing at a pretty, you know, fast clip, Medicaid being one of them, 14% increase. And as long as that continues to happen, there isn't going to be any money for transportation or other parts of the state budget.
And that is happening, though. I mean, with growth in non-discretionary spending, right. A reliance this year on one-time budget fixes, still, though, not a reason to raise fees and taxes?
Well, I think the first thing you have to do is, you know, and I think Charlie is a great manager. I think the administration is going to go in and they're going to look at every program and decide, you know, what we can afford and what we can't afford, and we have to live within our means. And again, the problem isn't that there isn't enough tax revenue coming in. You know, it's like a family using, you know, working off an operating budget, and it's, you know, they've spent way too much, and, you know, they're dipping into their savings, and it's just unsustainable.
Nancy Gertner, in your own history with the courts, where do cuts like this, not specifically these cuts, but when there it's a time of budgetary cuts, how do they affect the people that you work with?
Well, what happens is that you squeeze people, which is exactly what you shouldn't do. I have to admit, maybe it's the fatigue of the winter, but I'm also tired of budget discussions that are of the flavor, let's kick the can down the road, let's do the fix now and not pay attention to bridges and highways and the trap and the T in order to balance the budget this year. I think there has to be some long-term thinking, and the long-term thinking is we have an aging infrastructure. So if we don't address that, these problems are going to recur. Part of the Medicaid problem here, there was a huge kerfuffle over Medicaid because the health connector malfunctioned. So the one explanation was that something like, I think it was 100 to 300 million of the deficit was attributable to the Medicaid problem. People got kicked onto the Medicaid roll. So that won't be as much of a problem. And then the notion that we consider as discretionary funding, rather, higher education. That is incredible short-term thinking for a community that, you know, has to function as a metropolitan center and needs its people and to invest in its people. So I think there has to be a longer term view than just how to get out of this particular, to use a better word, pothole.
Speaking of which, many potholes out there. And in fact, Governor Charlie Baker went to Washington to try and get money for the state having every storm be declared a state of emergency, every storm that we've had so far, meaning that the United States, meaning that the state would be eligible for money from FEMA. And FEMA is part of the Department of Homeland Security. The Department of Homeland Security budget right now is very much in question. Richard, tell us what the latest is right now.
Well, from what I understand,
it runs out of money at midnight tonight, but there is a solution brewing.
From what I understand, the House has passed a three-week extension. The Senate's passed a year extension for the Homeland Security budget, and hopefully by the end of tonight, we'll have averted a shutdown. And I do think that this emergency aid is really important. I think it's up to 75% for cities and towns reimbursement for the cost of dealing with the storm. But, you know, I think both Democrats and Republicans down there are really playing with fire when you're playing with the Homeland Security budget.
Why would they then?
Well, because it all goes back to this immigration order that the president passed that a lot of people feel was illegal, and a court has issued an injunction against to prevent from going into effect. And, you know, and there are a lot of Republicans who wanted to, you know, they passed a Homeland Security bill that funded everything except for the executive order. I think that they made a mistake, though. Once the court came out and issued the injunction, I think that they should have declared victory and let it go through the courts rather than tie up the entire Homeland Security budget on just that one policy issue.
You actually are echoing what Democrat Congressman Jim McGovern told us yesterday.
I understand that they don't like my position on immigration. They don't like the president's position on immigration. They didn't like his executive order. But you have a federal judge that has just put a stay on that. So what's the deal? This is not the way to run a government.
He's talking obviously about Republicans there. Nancy Gertner, what's your take on this? What do you make of the fight among the three branches of government?
It sort of reflects again this sort of dysfunctional government. It is outrageous that one branch of the government is going to hold up something totally unrelated to the issue in order to make a point. And again, what hangs in the balance here is this region. I think that the costs of these storms are unimaginable, not just to the economic development of the region, but to individuals, to human beings, to children and families, et cetera. And the notion that we're going to basically hold hostage these funds is ridiculous. I do think that the issue belongs in the courts to some degree, although I would predict that this district court judge in Brownsville, Texas, will be reversed.
Also, a concern here is that if indeed there is no agreement by midnight tonight, workers like TSA workers, the people who check your bags at security at Logan Airport, will still have to be on the job. They just won't get paid for it until later.
Well, that's what I mean. This is not an area, given the world that we live in today, that you want to be playing politics with. And, you know, I think on both sides you have, a lot of stubbornness, and hopefully it will get worked out. Not just in the short term, but for a longer period of time.
Okay, I want to talk about the upcoming trial of Johar Tsarnaev. We're finally able to say that the trial is going to be really starting in full with opening arguments as of this coming week. I guess they're slated for Wednesday right now, barring any delays. It's a trial that is expected to last quite a long time. There could be a lot to say about this, but I just wonder if the two of you will tell us first what you are looking at as this trial gets underway. Nancy, for you, what's going to be the most interesting aspect of these proceedings as you're watching rather than running it, right. As a judge
of
the trial?
Well, first, it seems to me the public has to understand that one of the things that happens in a death penalty case is that the defense is duty-bound to raise every conceivable, colorable issue. The public may be tired of the challenges to the jury and change of venue and all of those issues. But the fact of the matter that when death hangs in the balance, the lawyers have to challenge everything. And as I've said on this program before, if there ever was a case for a change of venue, this was it.
And that, there's still a question about that now.
It's still up in the Court of Appeals. If there ever was a question that raised issues along these lines, this, of course, is that kind of case. I think the question will be, how much is the government going to, is the prosecutor going to replay the horrible images of the marathon, the stories of people's horrendous injuries and the pain of that event? They're entitled to show that it happened. How far they go to show the blood and gore and pain, which really is part of what happened, but may go further. How far the judge is going to let them is the question. How many times do you see images of explosions and people rushing about?
And as a judge, I mean, to the extent that you can put yourself in this judge's place, what would go through your mind as you decide whether or not more and more images should be shown?
Well, I mean, the classic situation that you get in an ordinary case is, you know, do you show the bloody pictures of the body? Just, you know, you want to show that there was a death, you show that there's a death. How many times do you let the jury get involved in what is really horrible pictures of blood and gore? And that's a judgment that a judge has to make, which is there's a certain point at which it no longer functions to establish that a crime was committed. It more is going to function to inflame the jury. And that's not an easy line to draw, but it seems to me it has to be drawn in this case. Otherwise, you have a jury that's not going to look at the facts, just look at the pain.
Right, but is that also more for the punishment phase?
It is, but that's the point, which is that the judge could say to the government, okay, enough already, now this is an issue of punishment, or the judge, in his discretion, could allow it at both ends, which would be unfortunate.
Richard, to say you are not involved in the judiciary at all, but you are a Bostonian, you could have been on this jury.
Yeah, I would just say I feel like I think a lot of other people feel, and that's just I am very interested to see what the tipping point was for this young man to go from, you know, from somebody who everybody who knew him thought would not be capable of doing something like this.
Nancy, so excuse me for a second. Nancy Gertner, is this something we would likely find out in the trial?
You're only going to find this out in the sentencing phase. Issues with respect to his character and his background are not going to be relevant in the liability stage. The first part of the trial is, did he do it? And the second part is, what should happen? And
what should happen, but in terms of the exploratory part of it, I mean, is anybody going to psychoanalyze him?
That's not going to happen until the sentencing phase, if at all. And that's, I mean, some of us have actually urged that he be allowed to plead guilty to life without parole, and there'd be a sentencing hearing tomorrow, which would bring all of that out.
And what I mean is I would be interested to see how much of this was religious zealotry, how much was his brother's influence, what does turn somebody like that, you know, to the dark side. And this is a huge problem, not, you know, only here in this case, but what we're facing with worldwide terrorism-wise.
Right, and the same question.
You know, what takes a, you know, how does, you know, if you look at what's happening around the world and in England and some other places, a lot of these young people or middle-class people, the kids, they've had great education, and how is it that they, you know, that they become capable of doing such things?
Right. And a global question that's very much brought home in this trial.
Exactly.
Okay, we only have a little bit of time left, just enough time for our hubbubs of the week, the stories that fall below the fold but have caught your eyes. Richard, you go first.
What caught my eye, you know, wasn't so much below the fold, but this whole net neutrality issue that came up this week. I was just very interested, and I'm probably agnostic on whether we should do it or not, but the whole fact that they had this hearing and voted for these regulations, 332 pages, never released the proposal to the public. So nobody actually knows what it was that they voted on. Doesn't seem to be a lot of transparency. Didn't go to the Congress. In fact, the chairman of the committee didn't show up at the congressional hearing. And it just seems that if you're going to make such a huge change on something that everybody uses, like the internet, that there should be a little more forthrightness from the federal FCC. And a little more transparency.
Of course, the huger change would have been if they had changed the rules,
well,
which they're not doing.
Right.
Right. But you're saying it should have been made public no matter what.
Well, if they have 332 pages of new regulations and there's been that much interest and controversy about them, I would think that before you take the vote, you at least release them and let the public see what you're doing.
Good. Okay. My hubbub, something completely different from that. This is about, I don't know if you have seen it yet, but it's a Ken Burns-style video, kind of a Ken Burns ripoff that's making the rounds online now. It shows a bunch of photos of Snowden Bostonians and their whiny Facebook posts. The video is called Facebook Status is About the Boston Snowstorm with a Sad Civil War Fiddle Music. And the creators are called the Safety Whale Comedy Collective. It is pretty darn good. Let's hear a little bit.
I think Boston is done. It's 6 feet of snow and rising. Public transport looks like it will never recover. I think this might be the end times. Harry Aspinwall, February 13th.
Many more testimonials as well, all with Southern or faux Southern accents. It's pretty darn good. You can check it out. In fact, we'll make a link on our website, radioboston.org. Nancy Gertner, last one for you.
Well, I have a confession to make. I mean, I am actually bereft over the death of Leonard Nimoy because no one knows this exactly. I am a Trekkie.
You're a Trekkie?
I'm a Trekkie.
Who would have thought?
And I loved his character and loved the sort of struggle between the rational self and even the emotional self. It was much more interesting in his face than in these dopey robot movies than we have seen. But yes, and I actually could deliver some decisions in the original Klingon, but I won't do it here.
You must do something here. Please. Just a little bit. And under what circumstances did you find yourself having to learn Klingon?
Well, when my kids were little, we would watch the news, and the reruns of Star Trek would go on afterwards, and my husband and I were both too tired to shut off the television. So we watched them and continued to watch them, and so we followed the series.
Please, just a little.
No.
All right, next time. Nancy Gertner, former federal judge, now a professor at Harvard Law School, and Richard Tessay, former state senator and congressional candidate. Thanks to both of you for coming
in. Thank you.
And stay with us. Coming up, we'll give a Boston Radio Vulcan salute to the original Mr. Spock, Boston native Leonard Nimoy, who died this morning in California. I'm Lisa Mullins, and this is Radio Boston.